This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. By this time next week, Barack Obama will be the 44th president of the United States after he's sworn in before an audience of millions on what forecasters say could be a snowy, chilly day. After lunch at the Capitol, the new president will lead a parade down Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House, and the evening to follow, we'll see every hall in the city host an inaugural ball. Throughout the day, D.C.'s subway will be jammed, some bridges and streets will be closed off, security will be very, very tight. Today, a look ahead to January 20th, the pomp, the ceremony, the traffic jams, the parties, did we mention the security? Later, NPR's Jackie Northam will join us to talk about what's likely to be one of the new president's first official acts and why an executive order to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay may take quite some time to carry out. But first, our inauguration preview. How big will the crowds be? Any chance of scoring tickets to see Bruce Springsteen or Sting or Aretha Franklin or any of the other star acts? How much will it all cost? And will we hear the new president say the words, "So help me God"? If you have questions about how it'll all work, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation at our website. Just go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. We begin with preparations by the District of Columbia and federal governments. Washington Post reporter and blogger David Nakamura joins us from the paper's offices here in Washington. He writes the Inauguration Watch blog for the Post. Nice to have you on the program today.
Hi, Neil.
What's the biggest, the latest crowd estimate?
Well, it's gone everywhere from 1 million to upwards of 4 million people. And the real sort of official estimate for planners' purposes has been around 2 million now. They're sort of meeting in the middle, I guess. And it's really a little bit difficult to say. Some of the federal and city officials had a press conference today. My colleague was there and fed a report to us that said one estimate that they're using is to look at charter buses. And they had expected maybe 10,000 charter buses. But so far, only 3,000 have applied for permits to park their buses in the city in these special zones they're going to have. And so that gives one estimate that you say, well, does that mean that the crowds are going to be down? Not necessarily. There's a lot of people saying they're going to be coming in groups, you know, in cars and things like that. And the mayor of D.C., Adrian Fenty, has said you can't necessarily predict based on this because they expect in this coming few days to get many more buses to register. And some buses may just not even register, not understanding that you have to. So it's a little bit unclear, but they're thinking between 1 million and 2 million now, which you know, could set an all-time record.
And could virtually double the city's population.
Absolutely. It's a city of less than 600,000 people. And so everything, you know, from all predictions, even if you're getting more toward the 1 million side, you're going to see a lot of crowds. And as you said, with security the way it is, they're preparing a lot more security this year, from what we're told, than before. And so, people coming should be prepared. A couple of things. Number one, you got to be patient. There's going to be lines, as you said, for subway lines to get into the secure zones if you have a ticket to see, you know, the swearing in. And the other thing, you know, be prepared to walk if you want to cut down, you know, maybe your wait time. You know, it may be cold, but, you know, there has been officials saying if you're anywhere within 2 miles of a place you want to be, you might want to start walking.
Well, Shank's mare might be the most reliable form of transportation indeed.
Absolutely.
Is this going to be a bonanza for the city businesses, restaurants, hotels, that sort of thing? Is this the new president's stimulus package for Washington, D.C.?
It doesn't seem like we're in an economic downturn here. I mean, you know, it's funny because there's talk of, you know, does the president-elect want to have an inauguration that sort of reflects the sort of difficult times we're in and maybe tones it down a little bit from the super celebration, even though it is a historic moment and people understand that. But, you know, frankly, you know, they said, oh, there's going to be 10 inaugural balls and they're going to be a little bit more, you know, respectful of the tone and this kind of thing. But frankly, as you know, I mean, there's so many unofficial inaugural balls going on. Almost every group, well over 50 or 60 of them around the city for four straight days, that, you know, the city government is allowing bars and restaurants to stay open 24 hours a day for five straight days, serve alcohol all the way till 4 a.m., which is 2 hours more than normal. So everybody's expecting a big, you know, sort of cash boom, at least for some of the local businesses. Whether the city as a whole sees a lot of extra tax revenue, no one's trying to get rich on this, it looks like, from the city's point of view. But the individual businesses may do well.
And people are scared of the crush if there are huge crowds. And are they going to control the number of people who will try to get on the mall, for example, to see the ceremony itself, or try to line the parade route?
Right now, they're saying they're not turning anyone away from the inauguration swearing in and Obama's address on the National Mall. The mall can hold up to, 3 million people or so. And, they're going to have, they just announced they're going to have jumbotrons of 20 of them or so on the mall all the way back to the Lincoln Memorial and beyond in case crowds get that big. Now, for the parade, there is a limited number of tickets for the bleachers. And also, they said that if once they reach a maximum number, of which they have not said what that is, they will turn people away from the parade route. And so I think the parade area, secure area, opens around 7 a.m. And they're saying, people are going to be camped out pretty early. Once they reach this magic number, we've heard estimates from maybe 250,000, 300,000 people on the parade route along Pennsylvania Avenue. The Secret Services, they have the right to close it down and turn people away. So if you want to see the parade, you don't have one of these bleacher tickets, you better get there early.
And let me ask you another question. There's going to be all kinds of celebrities in town holding various kinds of performances. Bruce Springsteen, Aretha Franklin, we mentioned earlier. Any tickets to those events left?
That's funny. You mentioned there's going to be the free concert, welcome concert that Obama is hosting on Sunday. It starts at 2 p.m. on the National Mall, open to everyone. You don't need a ticket. There's expecting maybe 500,000 people. It's at the Lincoln Memorial area. Could be cold. They're going to broadcast it on HBO and tape delay that night. But to the other events, they have not really announced how to get tickets to the 10 official balls. Other than if you donate up to $500 or more, then you get a guaranteed a ticket. Everybody's waiting to see if they'll go on sale for the $150 face value that most of these tickets are for. There's a number of other balls, like I said, and other events being hosted all around town. Jay-Z is performing, for example, at Warner Theater. I mean, there's, the Washington Post companies, TheRoot.com, which we own. It's a website, opinion website. They're hosting their own ball, for example, and Oprah Winfrey is supposed to come. I think those are all well sold out or whatnot. And so you have to kind of check on our Inauguration Watch blog. We've listed almost all the balls. You can go to that site, just click on the ball section and sort of see and, make your call to the website and try to get tickets. And it's, some ranged up to $1,000 for Russell Simmons' hip hop ball, for just a regular ticket. So they range in price and glitz.
Well, if you have questions about the inaugural ceremonies, including the ceremony we're all waiting to see, and that, of course, the swearing-in of the 44th President of the United States, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And finally, David Nakamura, who's paying for all this?
That's a good question. There's the federal government is footing the bill for some of it, but the district government as well has to pay a lot. And the federal government gave the city about $15 million. The city said they've already sort of allocated that. And D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, the three jurisdictions in this area, have asked the feds for $75 million, saying the security costs are going to be a lot more because they have to plan for these huge crowds, a lot more than ever before. And so I don't think the federal government has responded to that request yet. 4 years ago, the city was stuck with something of a bill for George Bush's second inauguration, but though not just a few million extra they had to pay. And so right now, there's really a lobbying effort going on. Mayor Fenty in D.C. has endorsed Barack Obama well before he won the election. So he's hoping his friendship there can maybe get him some points here and get him a little money.
David, thanks very much for your time today. Good luck with the blog and good luck with the crush.
Thanks a lot.
David Nakamura of the Washington Post. He writes the Inauguration Watch blog. Let's get a caller on the line again. It's 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Doug is calling us. Doug in Murphy's, California.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I'm very interested in the procedure that goes on prior to the inauguration and the parade when the Obamas visit the Bushes at the White House. I know they do something inside there, and then they all leave together, and then what happens in the White House while they're gone?
Well, we have the right person to answer your question. With us in the Studio 3A is Donald Ritchie, Associate Historian to the United States Senate, who keeps track of, all these kinds of things. Donald, nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you.
And can you answer Doug's question?
Well, I can tell you what's going on when they leave the White House, and that is all of the Bush family's furniture will be moved out, and all the Obama furniture will be moved in. The moving vans will actually be back in the south side of the White House ready to go at that stage. And there's quite a quick transformation between one family and the other.
All seven Santini brothers are there?
They will be working, I'm sure, very hard. The families do meet in the morning before they go down, and also usually the Joint Committee on the Inauguration sends a delegation up to the White House to escort the president. And so there will be a sort of a ceremonial get-together and shaking of hands before they get into the limousines to go down Pennsylvania Avenue.
And what happens with the former president's furniture?
It goes to wherever the former president is going. In this case, it'll be going to Dallas, Texas.
Doug, does that answer your question?
It certainly does. Thank you very much. And best wishes this whole year for Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much, Doug. We appreciate it. Best wishes to you, too. And, you know, when they're planning these ceremonies, they plan a long time in advance. How do they know what to plan for when they don't know who's going to be the president?
Well, they actually start about February of the year before. And so it's about almost a year in which they're doing their work. And a lot of the decisions have to be made long before the voters cast their ballots. So they begin construction of the inaugural platform in September, for instance. They also pick a theme for the inauguration.
They're lucky that both of the major candidates this year have the same number of letters in their names.
They tried to find something that will fit either candidate, and they're pretty good about that.
And so what's the theme for this inauguration?
This year will be the Lincoln Bicentennial. And, of course, Lincoln was not only the first Republican president, but he was also from Illinois, the signer of the Emancipation Proclamation.
Covering everybody's bases there.
Exactly.
So that's interesting. Now, there is a lot of tradition going on as well. The president-elect has said he's going to be taking the train down from Philadelphia on his way to the ceremonies in Washington, D.C. Of course, many presidents arrived in this city by train.
That's right. There are actually two different inaugural committees at work right now. One is the Joint Committee on the Inauguration, which takes care of everything at the Capitol. And the other is the President's Inaugural Committee, which takes care of everything before they get to the Capitol and after they leave the Capitol. And the train ride is really his plan, just as Bill Clinton arrived in a bus coming up from Charlottesville back in 1993.
We're talking with Don Ritchie. He is the associate historian to the United States Senate and, curator of all things inaugural. If you'd like to ask him some questions, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Pomp, circumstance, inaugural balls as Inauguration Day approaches. You may be so excited you feel as though you're stuck in traffic already. We've got the goods on what's going down a week from today, plus what went on in inaugurations past. Our guest, Don Ritchie, associate historian to the United States Senate, and we're taking your calls, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also go to a conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. And let's see if we get another caller on the line. This is Mary. Mary calling us from Cincinnati.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi, Mary.
We have tickets to the inauguration, and we're going to be staying with relatives, but we're fortunate we have cousins that live in the area. My question is, I was trying to plan to do this on public transportation, and where we're staying is near Mount Vernon, and it says that there's a bus that's leaving from Mount Vernon, Washington's home. Is that true? Will there be bus transportation from there to the metro station?
I have absolutely no idea, Mary.
No idea.
I'm sure there are websites you can go to check for it. Which county is that in?
It's in Fairfax County.
If you go to the Fairfax County website, I'm sure that they will find some way to let you know and how much it's going to cost.
Yeah, the prices seem reasonable on their metro. They're not expensive.
No, the metro's not too bad.
No, it's not too bad at all. But we're really looking forward to it. We're so excited. We've got tickets to the swearing-in.
Well, congratulations, Mary. I hope you have a great time.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Here's an email from Hollis in Falmouth, Massachusetts. We're coming down from Cape Cod with a friend. We live for 11 years in Fairfax County, and I help cover a couple of inaugurations for a wire service. We know our way around the city and plan to treat this gathering the way we used to treat the big 4th of July celebration on the mall. Get on the metro in Alexandria near where we're staying. Get off near the mall, then walk out of the district to a Virginia metro station when we're ready to leave. Or are we out of our minds? Don Ritchie, what do you think?
Well, all the recommendations are that you leave early that morning to get onto the metro. There may be much larger crowds than usual. Metro's never had more than 900,000 people on a particular day. For the Clinton administration inauguration, there were 800,000. We just don't know how many people will be trying to use the metro that day, and you may have to wait.
And we just have this information. One of our researchers is telling me that Metro is laying on various kinds of shuttle buses to get people to metro stations that morning, and that's on their website, metroopensdoors.com. Again, that's metroopensdoors.com, and we'll put that website, that web address on our website, too, if you didn't get there. Among the millions of people watching the inauguration here in Washington will be one of the pioneers of the civil rights movement. Minnie Jean Brown was a member of the Little Rock Nine, the group of black students who integrated Arkansas's Little Rock Central High School more than 50 years ago. Little Rock Nine were invited as honored guests of the Congressional Inauguration Committee, and Minnie Jean Brown Tricky plans to attend. She joins us now by phone from Birmingham, Alabama. Nice to have you on the phone today.
Well, I'm very pleased to join you today.
And how did you first hear that you were going to be an honored guest at the inauguration?
Well, I heard it from a Washington Post reporter who phoned me and asked me how I felt about it. And I said, I haven't heard yet. Are you sure? And he said, oh, yes, I'm sure. So we went from there. I went ahead with the interview and just found later that it was true.
Did you later get a formal invitation?
Yes. Very excited about that.
And what were your thoughts when Barack Obama announced that he was running for president, and your thoughts when you realized you were going to get to see him sworn in as president?
Well, when he first declared his candidacy, I said to my kids, why would he want to do that? And they all went hysterical and said, you should talk. So I thought, okay, shut me up. But I think this is a natural outcome, what one would expect after 50-plus years of civil rights activism and the struggles beforehand. But on the other hand, I had no expectation of a black president in my lifetime.
It sort of puts a different resonance on what happened 50 years ago.
Oh, it does. And it feels that it actually had real meaning. The struggles. Obviously, they had struggles. I'm right now in Birmingham, the site of a very brutal and crucial struggle, and I work with young people talking about the civil rights movement. So it's all kind of coming to fruition at this point. Of course, it's not the end of everything, but it certainly is a beginning, in my opinion.
The day before the inauguration happens to be Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Of course, I think everybody remembers the letters from the Birmingham jail.
Absolutely. So important. And Dr. King's vision, I think, which resonates as well, that he could see this. And maybe I could, too, when I was 15. But I got more jaded as I grew older. But I'm very pleased. I'm excited. I don't think I have good words to describe my feelings. It's an important, special thing, day for the American people. But I think the whole campaign raised our consciousness. We were able to think in terms of a female for president, a black person for president. There was this shift in consciousness, I think, during the campaign that I was just pleased about.
Do you stay in touch with the other members of the Little Rock Nine?
Well, yes, we're absolutely best friends because we had that special bond from 50 years ago to now, and we do quite a lot of work with young people. We're still working on and in the struggle. We have the Little Rock Nine Foundation that gives scholarships. We're really interested in education as one of the most important means of social change. So it doesn't end.
And it won't end even on Tuesday when you're here in Washington, D.C. For that historic day.
No, it won't. It'll just be another beginning. And I'm looking forward to the excitement of that beginning.
Can't wait to see you here in Washington.
Well, thank you very much.
Minnie Jean Brown Trickey speaking to us by phone from Birmingham, Alabama. She, along with the other members of the Little Rock Nine, will be here in Washington, D.C. a week from today for the inauguration of Barack Obama. Let's see if we get another caller on the line. Mary calling us from St. Charles, Missouri.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call. I love your show.
Thank you.
I was just wondering if there is a person, I, for the lack of a better word, like the wedding planner who tells the people when they can walk and when they have to wait and do stuff like that for the inauguration. Because every time I watch, it looks like it's all down to the minute.
Don Ritchie, is there a master planner?
Yes, indeed. There is a joint committee on the inauguration. It's chaired by Senator Dianne Feinstein of California. She has a staff built from the Senate Rules Committee that she chairs, and they do plan this down to the last second. In fact, last Sunday they had a dress rehearsal with members of the military wearing signs saying that they were Vice President Biden or President Obama, even the Obama children, where they would stand, what they would do, who would hold the Bible. They go through the whole process. And, of course, inside the Capitol, they're staging people like the governors and the Supreme Court justices, the members of the House, the members of the Senate, and bringing them out onto this platform, which holds 1,600 people, and bringing them out in such a way that it's orderly and dignified and that it moves on time and that the president will be sworn in at noon.
Now, during the State of the Union address, there's always one cabinet member who's asked not to attend because, well, heaven forfend, something could happen. There should be somebody in the chain of national command authority who is not in one building at the same time. Is the same true during an inauguration?
Well, of course, the new president's cabinet will not have been sworn in yet, so none of them are in the chain of command. So I'm not sure how they work that perhaps with the outgoing cabinet, whose positions are good until they're replaced. But it's true that just like the State of the Union message, this is the one opportunity in which all the branches of the government are together in one place. On the other hand, the security is enormous, and so they're probably better protected while they're there than when they're anywhere else.
Mary, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil. Bye-bye.
There's also been something of a controversy, and that has to do with the oath the president takes. Now, we've checked, and apparently historians cannot definitively say whether George Washington at his first inauguration added the words, "So help me God," or not. Nevertheless, it's been a tradition for quite some time, I guess since Chester Alan Arthur, not one of our more distinguished presidents. But this is something that has become, it's going to be a court case, too.
Well, the issue here is that the Constitution spells out the president's oath, and it's the only oath that's in the Constitution. It's the only person who takes that oath is the president, and it does not end with, "So help me God." The oath that the Congress has written for everyone else to take, including the staff of the Congress and judges and military officers, that does end with, "So help me God." We know that Chester Arthur and all presidents since Chester Arthur have either said, "So help me God," or just said, "I do." So that was probably post-Civil War, at a point when that Congress had rewritten the oath and added that phrase in. And Arthur, who'd served in the war as Quartermaster General, understood what the oath was in that sense. But there is evidence that Washington may have said it in 1789. Many of Washington's biographers say that he said it. The first person who apparently claimed it was Washington Irving, who was a little boy at the time. And he, 60 years later, recalled that. The problem is that almost no one could hear what Washington was saying at all. They did see him kiss the Bible. And, of course, we have the text of his inaugural address in which he mentions God. But there's no contemporaneous proof that he said, "So help me God," in 1789.
Washington, not a stentorian orator.
He was a very quiet-spoken man, and before there was no amplification. It's not till Warren Harding that you have a microphone for a president.
Let's get Bob on the line. Bob with us from Cleveland.
Hello.
Hi, Bob. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Michael. Mr. Riley, I have a question for you. My daughter's doing civics, 15-year-old girl, bright, said, "Why does a president, when he's reelected, have to take another inaugural oath? He's already sworn to protect the country."
An issue Barack Obama may not have to face for 4 years, if then, but Don Ritchie?
Every federal official who has a set term has to take an oath at the beginning of the next term. So all the United States senators who are reelected in this election, who, even though they've been serving in the past, including Joe Biden, all took another oath. And the president and any other federal official takes an oath at the beginning of that term.
So it's based on the term, not upon the position.
That's right.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob. Now you got an answer for it. This from Jerry in Tucson, Arizona. I just wanted to comment on the multinational aspect of this event. My son and his wife are living in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. They plan on attending an inauguration ball there organized by a British woman and held in the Italian club. Bodes well for healing America's image. We're talking about preparations for the inauguration with Donald Ritchie, who's the associate historian to the United States Senate. 800-989-8255. If you'd like to join us, email us. talk@npr.org. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we were just mentioning the so help me God. I gather not every president has put his hand on a Bible.
Theodore Roosevelt, for some reason, didn't use a Bible for one of his inaugurations. It may have been the swearing-in when he became president after McKinley died. Sometimes there isn't a Bible immediately present. I think when Lyndon Johnson took the oath, there was a scurrying around to try to find a Bible for that oath at that point. The Constitution does not require that a person take an oath on the Bible. And a lot of what we do today actually began with Washington. Washington did take the oath on the Bible, and he gave an inaugural address, which also isn't in the Constitution. But there are certain traditions that have endured.
When did the inaugural parade begin?
Well, Washington actually had parades in New York in 1789 and cannon firing and balls and other things like that. After Washington, it took a little while. When Thomas Jefferson was inaugurated, the first in Washington, D.C., he just walked across the street from his boarding house to the Capitol. It was very unpretentious. But later, and James Madison was sworn in, there was a military parade. And over time, these inaugural parades have grown to very large operations, many hours and many, many people involved.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. 800-989-8255. This is Alan. Alan with us from Lawrence, Kansas.
Hi. I also have a question my daughter's raised. She's asked me a couple times what happens when the president is dead or passes away prior to the inauguration and swearing-in ceremony. What's the process? Does the vice president elect and become president, et cetera?
Yes, there's a provision in the 20th Amendment that deals with that, that if anything happens to the president-elect in the interim before the election, the vice president-elect would be sworn in. If something should happen to both, the House of Representatives elects a president and the Senate elects the vice president.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. We're answering a lot of daughters' questions today. Another question about the location of the swearing-in, since it's been held at the Capitol. The site has switched over the years from the east side of the Capitol building, which is really the front of the building, to the west side with a sweeping view down the Mall to the Washington Monument and down to the Lincoln Memorial. Now, the way I heard it, that was first used for Ronald Reagan, and that he was, of course, from California and wanted to look west.
Well, that's the assumption. But, of course, the Joint Committee on the Inauguration made that decision in the summer of 1980, and they long before they knew whether Ronald Reagan was going to be elected.
Maybe they were reading the polls.
They were just looking for a bigger place to hold the inauguration, that they could accommodate more people on the West Front, and they could also use the terraces designed by Frederick Law Olmsted as sort of a natural stage. Instead of having to construct a large platform, which they had been doing for years on the East Front, and frankly, if Jimmy Carter had been reelected or if John Anderson had won that election, they would have been inaugurated on the West Front. The difference is that Reagan was an actor and he understood the importance of a stage. And when he realized he was going to be inaugurated on the West Front, he wrote it into his inaugural address that he was looking to the West over these monuments and over the graves of the heroes in Arlington Cemetery towards the Pacific. And people therefore assumed that he had asked for it to be on that side. In fact, he was the beneficiary of decisions made before he was elected.
And why is it held in January, the coldest month of the year here in Washington?
Believe it or not, that was a reform. Before, it used to be held in March, on March the 4th. But that meant there were 4 months between the election of the president and the swearing-in of the new president. And while in the 18th and early 19th centuries, that gave people time to travel and to put together a government and sort of the leisurely way you did things, into the 20th century, that was really obsolete. And ironically, the last time that was done was in 1932 to 33. They had actually passed the amendment to the Constitution to move it up to January, to half the amount of time between the election and the inauguration. the economy collapsed during that period. There was this desperate need for doing something, and yet the outgoing president, Herbert Hoover, and the incoming president, Franklin Roosevelt, just couldn't work together at all, and the country went into almost a free fall during that period.
Well, it seems like it's been endless since November the 4th. Anyway, we have not time to go to Jim on the line from Dexter, Michigan, but I'll ask his question. He's planning for his class. When is the inaugural address given? What time of day?
Well, the oath will be given at noon, and the inaugural address then will take place immediately after the oath taking.
So noon 3, noon 4, noon 5.
As long as the applause takes to die down.
Oh, that could be a while. Donald Ritchie, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Donald Ritchie joining us here in Studio 3A. He's the associate historian to the United States Senate. Coming up, it's been reported that President-elect Obama plans to issue an executive order on his first day in office to direct the closure of the Guantanamo Bay detention camp. We'll find out more. Stay with us. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.